important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
A decade after demonstrators massed in Bahrain's capital to call for the downfall of their government back in 2011, authorities continue to suppress all signs of opposition. However, Bahraini people continue their movement with the aim of reform in a country where an oppressive regime is not compatible with the will of the Bahraini nation. A decade into the Bahraini revolution force in this following report.
A decade after demonstrators massed in Bahrain's capital to call for the downfall of their government in 2011, authorities continue till now to suppress all signs of dissent. Bahrainis view the entire experience of the most suppressed revolution in the region as a threat for the monarchy's grip on power, all but extinguished. Although many activists and protesters have escaped into exile or been imprisoned, the thrust of the revolution persists in this tiny kingdom with a majority Shia population off the eastern coast of Saudi Arabia. In contrast to neighboring Persian Gulf Arab monarchies, unrest has plagued Bahrain over recent years. Police have been out in force in city streets over the past week, taking no chances on renewed demonstration against the oppressive monarchy. For weeks, beginning on February 14, 2011, thousands thronged streets across Bahrain, emboldened and energized by the popular protests roiling in Egypt and Tunisia. Bahrain's protests were organized primarily by the nation's majority Shia population, seeking greater political rights in the Persian Arab Gulf state, which is a key Western ally and home to the U.S. Navy's 5th Fleet. The heady days in the Pearl Roundabout were nothing short of overwhelming, the symbolic center of the capital Manama, which was later bulldozed by authorities. It was something that no Persian Gulf Arab monarchy had ever seen. People knew they were being ruled unconstitutionally by a king supported by powerful monarchies and Western states. Yet they founded their calling to march against the oppressive Al-Khalifa regime. Soon enough, though, everything went horribly wrong. Security forces tried to disperse the sit-in, responding to protests with torrents of tear gas, rubber bullets, and in many cases, live fire. Leave it for the big gangster brother next door in Saudi Arabia to send in the war machine to suppress popular calls for constitutional reform, which later turned into demands for the dismantling of the country's political structure after foreign troops were brought in to crush the popular protests. Sure, a decade has passed since the revolution of the Bahraini people with the aim of implementing radical and serious reform began. Yet the people of Bahrain seem adamant on continuing their peaceful movement with the aim of retaking their country from the hands of the oppressive Saudi puppet Al-Khalifa regime.
Now to discuss this issue with us from London is former Bahraini Prime Minister Jawad Fayrouz. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Fayrouz. Now, Bahrain has one of the oldest civil rights movement in the region. Almost half of the population of the Bahraini citizens took part in the protests per capita, if you actually put it in comparison with other Arab countries. Yet the media blackout on the Bahraini revolution was unprecedented. Who was and still is protecting the Bahraini ruling class, at least from being exposed out in the media?
Yeah, first of all, thank you very much to having me and to focusing on this decade of the uprising Bahrain. But let me correct, I am former MP and not former Prime Minister, as you mentioned by mistake.
I'm sorry.
That's correct. Okay. Yes, from beginning it was so clear that the media is not giving enough or fair chance for a Bahrain uprising to be covered. And unfortunately, the most media's establishment, it is linked to the certain types of the international interest, which is linked to the political interest of these countries who are either funding or a part of this media empire. So yes, Bahrain is not being taken fair coverage out of this media. It was just at the beginning of the uprising, partially some coverage was there, but not totally fair. But as we can read nowadays, it has really been forgotten to be covered by the media. But I'm gonna be sure that, and whatever is depends on all the activities, how the activists inside Bahrain and abroad, they can approach and they can bring up more focus to Bahrain. I think this is a big challenge for all those activists that they have to do.
Well, in the early 2011, when the protests actually began at the Pearl Roundabout, with two aims. First, to release the political detainees which were incarcerated by the regime, and second, for the king to fulfill his 2001 promise for the return of the 1973 constitution of Bahrain. Now, the demands did not change to include the actual removal of the regime until there was killing of protesters on the streets of Bahrain and also inside prisons. You reckon that the strategy of torture and killing were actually successful, which led to the maybe descent or decrease in the thrust of this revolution?
I think to be more realistic, the demand at the beginning was not just to free some prisoner conscious or just to fulfill all the promises that had been given in 2001. After almost a decade after the National Act had been voted on, the demand was a rooted reform, a sustainable rooted reform within the system. It is not just to go back to the 1973 constitution or any other amendments that had been promised to do it. So somehow it was so clear that after the opposition joined the parliament in 2006 and still the people will have a little bit, not that much hopeful that the regime will be cooperative to adopt any reforms, especially political reforms. So that was a chance that people to express their demand once again. And yes, after the killing, some groups, some opposition groups or some protesters demanded overthrow the regime, but it was not being, let me say, an agreed on demands by all parties, especially the political societies. Opposition political societies were almost had the majority of their followers who've been active during that time. And they continue to demand the reforms, and I think now still the majority of the opposition demanding the reform of the regime and not overthrowing the regime, although there are some groups still they are demanding overthrow of the regime.
Well, what's very much interesting that's found in the media is that sectarianism is being played as the far too simplistic form of explaining the Bahraini revolution. Because basically, Western editors, they find it juicier to talk about sectarianism in Bahrain than the actual events on the ground. Now, despite that, it is a fact that 80% of the population of Bahrain are actually Shia Muslims. They are being ruled by a minority of elite being put forward by the Saudi regime. Why would asking for simple democracy make the Bahraini revolution a sectarian one in the eyes of those who want to at least criticize it?
I think this is the game of the regime because they fail to admit that there is an absolute power or there is a full dictatorship, a monarchy type in Bahrain. There is absolute monarchy. So they escape for challenging the demand of the people, which is fair demand, democratic demand, then they want to give impression that the demands are sectarian, or even they want to lead them to the violence. So for sure, because they fail to have any types of the dialogue or to look after the demands as a right demands and so on, which are they are the demands. When it comes to demands like elected government or full power to the elected parliament, and the same time to have an equal citizenship through one man, one vote, or when demand is related to the independent judiciary and security for all it is national demand. It is nothing to do with any type of the sectarian demands. For that reason, deliberately regime try to give indication that it is just a struggle between different communities in Bahrain in the sectarian background. So deliberately, they demolish the mosque to let these Shias who want to protect their mosque to make retaliation and go and attacks a Sunni mosque, and this is what not done, not happened, because mm-hmm. the people so are much aware, and yet all those being oppressed, they've been oppressed through their beliefs, through their thoughts, through their sectarian types of the institutions, types, but still didn't take any, they didn't inflame any type of the sectarian struggle. Yet Bahrain's is going toward demands of the old people, not for particular Shia demands.
But you yourself, Mr. Fayrouz, as a former member of parliament, now seeing the situation in Bahrain from outside, living in London right now, you understand probably more than others that reform now depends on the wider political situation in the entire region, not only in Bahrain, especially because Bahrain has a very important geopolitical role in the region, being home to the U.S. Navy's 5th Fleet, which is a very big deal for the West there. With the current political stalemate in the entire region, what are the options that are left for the Bahrainis to take in order to at least be part of the political making decision inside the country?
First of all, we believe, and majority of Bahrain believes, that the permanent stability and a permanent security will not be maintained with the current regime going on. It is so fragile, any incident can collapse everything, and we could see that during the change in White House, the regime become a little bit scary, that maybe it will be imposed on them, their reform. For that reason, we wanted and demanded, and we think that the root is solutions to be avoid from any type of the crisis, as everyone knows that the crisis initially was political, then it led to the security crisis, then it led now to the economical, social crisis. So crises are compiling without mm-hmm, any vision mm-hmm. towards solutions. So here, when the opposition demanding the rooted and sustainable type of the continuous reforms, the political reforms, based on the human rights principle and to achieve sustainable developments. So only through that vision we can maintain the security
well,
and
want,
stability.
Well, I want to thank you very much, former Bahraini Bahraini Member of Parliament, Jawad Fayrouz, for joining us to talk about the 10-year-long revolution in Bahrain, which is still going on, by the way. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Fayrouz, and thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
The Limelight.
Over three-quarters of Americans believe senators voted based on partisan politics, compared with 23% who think they voted based on the facts. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Kenny Stansil Ryder. This article is published under the heading Poll shows nearly 60% in U.S. believe Senate should have convicted Trump. Stay tuned for the details, please. Three Republican senators voted to acquit former President Donald Trump of inciting a violent insurrection, but a new poll released recently shows that nearly 3 out of 5 Americans think the Senate should have convicted Trump for his role in the assault on the U.S. Capitol. The poll conducted online on February 13th to 14th in English and Spanish by ABC News Ipsos and based on a nationally representative probability sample of 547 adults shows that 58% of the U.S. public believes Trump should have been convicted for inciting the events of January 6th that left 5 people dead. while close to 60% of the country overall says Trump should have been found guilty, support for conviction breaks down along sharply partisan lines. Almost 90% of self-identified Democrats believe the former president should have been convicted. By comparison, 64% of independents and just 14% of self-identified Republicans think so. A majority of respondents, that is about 56%, agree that the prosecutor's evidence as presented by House impeachment managers during the Senate trial was strong, while 37% say it was weak. Opinions about the strength of evidence against Trump, however, are also subject to a clear partisan divide, with a strong majority of Democrats believing the evidence is strong and very few Republicans agreeing. There is a bipartisan consensus about the influence of partisanship on senators' votes. Of those surveyed, 77% think political considerations played a role in how senators voted, whereas just 23% believe senators voted based on the facts in the case. According to the poll, nearly equal numbers of Democrats and Republicans believe the senators voted based on politics. The Senate recently acquitted Trump by a margin of 57 to 43, 10 votes shy of the two-thirds majority required for conviction. The inability of congressional Democrats to persuade even 10 of their Republican counterparts in the Senate to vote to convict Trump for inciting a deadly insurrection was viewed by progressive lawmakers and activists, as Common Dreams reported over the weekend, as further evidence for why the majority party must eliminate the legislative filibuster to have any chance of enacting its agenda on voting rights, climate, and other crucial issues. As Senator Bernie Sanders tweeted recently, the impeachment trial was about more than Trump's speech before the Capitol attack on January 6th. It was about whether we remain a democracy or move toward authoritarianism. Big lies, racism, divisiveness, violence, and one-man rule, said Sanders. That's what the trial was about, and that's what 43 Republicans voted for. In a column published in Common Dreams recently, political scientist Jeffrey C. Isaac argued that in the wake of Trump's acquittal, Democrats must make real what they claim the impeachment trial would do. That is, they must prosecute authoritarianism and strengthen democracy by advancing reforms in the face of determined ideological opposition. I am no master strategist. I have no master strategy, wrote Isaac. But I do think that it might be possible for Democrats who have been understandably focused on the justice of an impeachment trial to pivot from Senate acquittal of Trump to a robust Democratic agenda that is not focused on Trump, but is very much focused on remedying the serious problems that gave rise to Trump and might yet allow the plague he unleashed upon us to rise up again, he added.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Hello.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a televised speech delivered on January 8, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, on the anniversary of an uprising led by the people of the city of Qom on January 9, 1978.
We need to protect the memory of that event, and another is that we should preserve and guard its content and meaning. In other words, we need to protect the event itself in the sense that we are obliged to keep it alive, and also we need to protect the content of that great epic. I will mention why. Protecting the memory of the 19th of day as one of the highlights of the Iranian nation's life. As for why we should protect that glorious event, it is because it was one of the highlights of the Iranian nation's life. Nations have certain highs and lows. We should preserve the highs. The highs are those which manifest a nation's liveliness, preparedness, motivation, determination, and insight in sensitive times. The 19th of day was like that. Therefore, the highlights and peaks should be kept alive as they boost the morale of future generations, and they are also a source of pride and national dignity.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
These peaks should be recorded in history and show future generations which path they should take. Therefore, the event in itself should not be allowed to become dated, and we should continue to keep it fresh and alive as we have done so until today. As for protecting its content, well, every event has a content and a meaning. What was the content of that event? We should gain a correct understanding about its content and then protect and guard it. Why should we guard it? Because treacherous narrators and analysts with ulterior motives try to distort the content of great events to their own benefit and to the benefit of uprising powers in the world. This practice has existed since long ago. Narrators with ulterior motives narrate an event in a way that the opposite meaning is portrayed in the minds of the audience. Today, with the development of means of mass communication and numerous other technologies, corrupt powers and treacherous hands are capable of changing events and their content.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Around the world with reporters. The latest available data suggests only 4.8% of EU citizens have so far been vaccinated against COVID-19. Frustration levels are growing because it is not yet clear when people living in the 27-nation bloc can expect to receive the jab.
Of course, everybody needs to speed up. All the countries, France, Belgium, Germany, it's all hanging. We're all hanging around and just waiting.
For example, in France, for my grandparents, it's quite hard to get some appointments to have a dose.
We should speed up a little more and start vaccination a lot. Vaccinate people a lot.
In hindsight, it turned out a bad decision that the EU was responsible because the overall administration is so complex it would have been easier to have this set up on a national level.
That widely held opinion is being rejected by the head of the European Commission.
With the purchasing power of 27, we were able to agree on this enormous volume I've just described, 2.3 billion doses.
So where are these doses? Experts say the reason the UK and US are way ahead of the EU on vaccination is because the European Commission was too slow to sign contracts with producers, and approval to use the jabs is also a sluggish process.
Mass vaccination centres like this one in Brussels are popping up right across the European Union. On the face of it, that sounds like a great thing. The problem is they are practically empty due to vaccine supply issues.
The European Commission has just launched a plan designed to detect variants of the disease earlier and share this information across the EU. The problem is that mutations are allowed to form when large numbers of people are not vaccinated.
We are ready to go one step further and to propose an emergency authorization of vaccines at EU level with shared liability among us if there's a decision by the European leaders to move in this direction.
The economic consequences for the EU of this slow vaccines rollout are almost immeasurable. The political consequences for the project might prove fatal, according to some analysts. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The family of Dubai's billionaire ruler, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, has once again made headlines. Back in 2018, the Sheikh's daughter, Sheikha Latifa, posted a video of herself just before making an abortive attempt to flee Dubai.
All my father cares about is his reputation. He will kill people to protect his own reputation. He only cares about himself and his ego. So this video could save my life.
In a new video published by the BBC, Latifa says on the last leg of her escape to India that her boat was intercepted and she was beaten, injected with a tranquilizer, and dragged back to Dubai.
I'm a hostage, and this villa has been converted into a jail. All the windows are barred shut. I can't open any window. I've been by myself, solitary confinement. No access to medical help. No trial, no charge, nothing.
But the Sheikh has denied the charges against him, describing his daughter's return to Dubai as a successful rescue operation. He insists she is now safe and in perfect health, but has yet to provide any evidence. Latifa's story is considered to be the latest in a series of scandals the Sheikh is grappling with. In March 2020, the UK's High Court found Sheikh Maktoum guilty of waging a campaign of fear and intimidation against Princess Haya, the youngest of Sheikh's six wives, and abducting her two adult daughters, Princess Latifa and Princess Shamsa, who was snatched off the streets of the city of Cambridge in England. It is said that Tony Blair's Labour government dropped a criminal inquiry into Shamsa's abduction as a diplomatic favour to the Sheikh. And it seems those favours keep coming, as the UK is still reluctant to condemn the billionaire.
I think it is concerning. We always raise human rights issues with all of our partners, including the UAE. There's no particular British locus in this case, but we are concerned by this.
But the statement appears to be far from the truth, as London heavily supports a deadly military campaign waged by the UAE and Saudi Arabia on Yemen. The country, the United Nations says, is facing the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. The new video of Sheikha Latifa has escalated international pressure on the UAE. Amnesty International expressed concern about Latifa's well-being, saying her detention amounts to torture. It also added that this case brings into light the other human rights violations for which the UAE has repeatedly come under fire. The UN also said it will discuss the matter with the UAE, noting that the international body could launch a thorough investigation into Latifa's fate.
Following the bitterly disputed 2020 election campaign, top pollster Gallup has found that support for third parties is at its highest point ever in the United States. 62% of people agree that a third party is needed because Democrats and Republicans, quote, do such a poor job representing the American people. Another polling record was also recorded. The number of Americans who identify as an independent is now at 50%.
And everybody's tired of it. Everybody is fed up with the hypocrisy and ineffectiveness of the Democrats in the terms that they claim to want to be effective. I think they're actually very effective in what they're actually doing. And the Republicans, of course, you know, they have one program, which is tax cuts for the rich.
Ex-President Donald Trump, who remains banned from top U.S. social media, issued a rare statement which attacked top Republican leadership. That's being interpreted as a sign that he may stay within the mainstream and try to make so-called Trumpism the undisputed platform of the Republican Party. However, there is much speculation that Trump will start a new third party. Polls say a Trump-led third party would attract not just two-thirds of Republicans, but also 30% of independents and even 15% of Democrats. The party would push Republicans into third place, ushering in a new era of multi-party plurality and ending what is probably the world's oldest political duopoly.
Certainly those people are out there ready for the picking for a third party that they perceive as A, fighting for things that are important to their daily lives, and B, treating them with respect and not treating them as, you know, you're a racist and fascist and you know, sexist and whatever.
Trump won in 2016 by running as a so-called outsider candidate, and while he is unemployed 4 years later, rejection of the two mainstream parties is now the majority sentiment. The most popular third parties currently in the U.S. are the Libertarians, who are associated with a strong demand for individualism, the Greens, the Party for Socialism and Liberation, and the Alliance Party, a coalition for independence. Those parties combined for under 2% of the 2020 presidential vote. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Alleged favoritism at the heart of the British government, committed by Dominic Cummings, the former top aide to Prime Minister Boris Johnson. UK High Court documents suggest he played an instrumental role in awarding a lucrative contract to a polling firm run by his friends in March last year. There was no formal contract, prior advertisement, or competitive tender process. After only a shake of hands, Public First, a company run by two former colleagues of Cummings and Cabinet Office Minister Michael Gove, was paid £540,000 out of the public purse in March last year to research Britain's understanding of the coronavirus and the government's messaging around the pandemic. What started as an informal contract was only formalized retrospectively in June 5 and publicized a week later.
Yet another black mark against the government in its whole handling of the COVID-19 crisis and other situations in which there seem to have been shortcuts made, handing out very large contracts, very valuable contracts indeed, to friends and even family of Conservative ministers or donors to the Conservative Party.
The story was first revealed by The Guardian and Open Democracy in July last year, but was brushed aside as nonsense. In a written statement to the UK High Court, which he did not attend, Cummings admitted he was friends with the company's directors, but denied he recommended them for that reason. He claimed there had been no time to follow usual procurement rules, and the work was crucial to the government's early pandemic response. But the Good Law Project, the not-for-profit campaign group that has brought the judicial review of the contract, disagrees, saying money paid to associates on a handshake and formalized later is unlawful.
Quite frankly, it's not acceptable that there has to be a robust system in place which ensures that all contracts are awarded to companies on the basis of their performance and not on the basis of who they know.
The judge in the case is yet to fix a date for a ruling, but the Good Law Project say they're determined that the truth should see the light of day. Although the government is desperate to keep this and similar cases under wraps for their considerable public importance. Saeed Bourza, London.
EU finance ministers have concluded 2 days of talks relating to the 27-country bloc's dire economic situation resulting from the COVID-19 pandemic.
It has been a particular challenge for young women and men, but also those who are employed in contact-intensive parts of our economies.
One such person is Simon Ledoux, who worked in the hospitality industry in Brussels. He feels abandoned by the state since losing his job.
I feel very depressed. I'm looking for a job, but I didn't find. And my friends, like me, didn't find job.
The social crisis in the EU continues to deepen. Richer member states are being urged to support poorer ones. Within the EU, social rights campaigners say solidarity is now needed like never before in the bloc's history, because of huge disparities among member states in terms of their ability to cope and recover. The European Commission warns a record number of businesses will go under when governments start easing financial aid programmes. The Commission claims firms that were not viable prior to the crisis will be impacted most. Only six EU nations have so far submitted draft plans to draw down money from a €750 billion coronavirus recovery fund.
I call on the remaining countries to ratify the own resources decision quickly so that the Commission can start its borrowing program under the Next Generation EU.
Illegal US sanctions against Iran preventing EU businesses from trading with the Islamic Republic show how the dollar is too dominant over the euro. Eurozone finance ministers have been encouraged to strengthen the currency's position on the international stage.
Recent episodes where the dollar was used as a policy tool reminded us that this is not good from a European perspective.
Economists warn the biggest threat to the Eurozone economy right now is the EU's dysfunctional COVID-19 vaccination strategy. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
After months of discussion and some rough debates, members of the French Parliament have voted a new law, officially called the Law on Principles of the Republic. French authorities say they want to strengthen the respect of equality, fraternity and liberty. But the opposition denounces, as it was called first, the law on separatism. They sound the alarm on the stigmatization of the Muslim community.
More and more children do not go to the same schools because of the social origin of their parents. That's school separatism. Without saying it, this law concerns only our fellow Muslim citizens and creates a debate on identity rather than on social problems. During weeks, this debate has been a festival of discrimination towards Muslims.
French Interior Minister Darmanin already said that mosques will be closely monitored. Law experts say that this text can be interpreted in different ways, which could lead to arbitrary decisions like the closure of watchdog associations defending the rights of Muslims. Opposition members in the parliament blame the government for not being concerned about the real social problems of the population.
Yes, there is a separatism in this country, a separatism in school and in the French territory. This bill does not speak about it. Our children, depending on which school they go to, do not have the same chances. The public school is weakened.
The opposition group in the French Parliament also criticizes the actual French government for seducing far-right voters, as the new French president will be elected in only a year. What is more important, security issues or social welfare?
We had 2 years of social agitation with a yellow vest movement and a movement against the retirement law. The poverty and social inequality are exploding in France. But no, they debate on the headscarf.
The reaction of the Muslim community is taking form, but slowly and in a dispersed order. Hundreds demonstrated in Paris, and hundreds of religious leaders and human rights associations asked members of parliament in a public letter not to vote this law on separatism. The law has been adopted by a majority in the French parliament, but Muslims and human rights defenders already promised to continue the protest. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
Turkish president vowed that the cross-border military operations that Turkish military is conducting against PKK will continue, as he confirmed Ankara's willingness to expand areas of operations from which threats against Turkey are coming, assuring that the death of 13 Turkish citizens who lost their lives in the Gara attack will strengthen the government's determination to eliminate terrorist groups.
Northern Iraq's Gara province has now been made secure as a result of a 4-day military operation. We will stay in the areas that we have made safe in a bid to avoid similar attacks. Gara was a troubled region. It is taken now and the problem is gone.
Turkish Defense Minister, along with Interior Minister, met with opposition figures Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu and Meral Akşener separately and explained in details the military operation that was conducted in the region. The two ministers also briefed the parliament on the circumstances of the operation and the martyrdom of 13 Turkish citizens on the hands of PKK. Analysts say the meetings and parliament session were in preparation to draft a resolution to grant the Turkish army the permission to hold wide-range cross-border operation in Sinjar and other areas in northern Iraq.
The war between Turkey and the PKK has been going on for decades. However, I think this time a decision is being made to eliminate the group's terrorists wherever they are. The operation will include Sinjar and Kandil areas. I think all political parties will agree on launching a wider cross-border operation, despite knowing that such a decision will be met with opposition from European countries and, of course, Turkey's NATO ally, the United States.
Turkey accused the U.S. of siding with terrorists. Turkish president said the U.S. statement concerning the death of 13 Turkish citizens is considered, quote, a joke. Other Turkish politicians and political parties also condemned it, saying the U.S. exposed its cooperation with PKK in such a statement. It seems that, unlike Turkish expectations, the new U.S. administration, like its predecessors, will continue to support the Kurdish groups. Many expect the two NATO allies go into another round of tensions. Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
February 2011. Emboldened by what was then hailed as the Arab Spring, people took to the streets in Bahrain. The crackdown that followed was brutal. Hospitals overflowed with the dead and injured, and the prisons filled up. On the 10th anniversary of the pro-democracy movement, the European Centre for Democracy and Human Rights held a conference. According to the speakers, the situation in Bahrain is worse now than before 2011, with hundreds of journalists, human rights defenders, and opposition figures still behind bars. The US and the UK have military bases in Bahrain. Human rights organizations say both are complicit in the monarchy's rights abuses by refusing to exert the influence they obviously have over the monarchy.
Bahrain is a political ally of the West. It's not some other, you know, this country that there is no kind of form of leverage or control over. In fact, the strength of US and British leverage on the regimes is so strong that it actually, I would say, coerce some of these regimes into entering the normalization deal with Israel that was perceived by, you know, across the board in Bahrain, you know, pro and anti-government people as the final act of betrayal.
One aspect of Bahrain's repressive tactics has received international attention: torture and sexual abuse used in prisons. And the UK's complicity is irrefutable. It trained Bahrain's police force, which carries out the torture, and the Special Investigations Unit, which continues to fail the victims. Some are on death row after giving false confessions under duress, and others live on with the horror playing before their eyes every day. We spoke to one of the victims.
It wasn't a prison, it was a morgue. You had no right to say you were innocent. If you did, they would start the torture, psychological torture. They would give us hallucination drugs. None of the guards were Bahraini. And they weren't normal. They were sick. They would make fun of us for missing our kids and family. Those who had kids were tortured the most. They weren't allowed to have visitors if they so much as drank water without permission. I think of those women. God help them.
Britain's top military brass were in Bahrain 5 days before the 2011 crackdown, in which 1,000 Saudi troops trained and equipped by the UK backed Bahrain's security forces. And since then, Britain has given Bahrain £6.5 million worth of technical assistance. Pressure is growing on Westminster to end the collusion. But Downing Street's damning record proves strategic interests trump human rights concerns every time. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Palestinian prisoners incarcerated in the Israeli military jail of Aufer started a partial strike by refusing to take their meals in protest against the escalated successive repression and assaults of the Israeli prison service. According to the Palestinian Prisoners Club Association, for almost 2 weeks, prisoners in Aufer jail have been subjected to harassment and repression, including surprise night raids and intensive unannounced cell search, strip searches, and being sprayed with poisonous gases, in addition to deliberate medical negligence.
A big number of administrative detainees are held in Aufer. What's going on there amounts to a crime being planned by the prisoners' officials. They want to bring the prisoners of Aufer to their knees. They have escalated their aggressive measures, such as carrying out several surprise searches of cells day and night.
Hundreds of Palestinian prisoners are held in Aufer jail, including minors. Prisoners' advocacy groups say the inmates have sent a clear message to the prison administration that if these invasions and assaults that are against international laws and the Geneva Convention do not come to an end, then the prisoners will escalate their protest measures within the coming days.
Prisoners' lives are in danger because they don't intend to remain silent against this brutality. Prisoners now are planning other measures to protest their conditions, including refusal to talk with prison administrators and starting an open-ended hunger strike.
Reports say over 4,500 Palestinians are currently languishing in a number of Israeli jails, including hundreds being held without charge or trial under the illegal imprisonment known as administrative detention. Palestinian prisoners have always endured grievous oppression in Israeli jails. However, people in the occupied territories are worried today about their loved ones. They are concerned not only about recent brutal measures taken in the Israeli jail of Ofer, but also about the reports that more inmates there and in other jails have been tested positive for the coronavirus. Muna Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, which was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. We start from where we left you last week, and here is Ayah 15 of Surah Ahqaf.
ووصينا الإنسان بوالديه إحسانا حملته أمه كرها ووضعته كرها وحمله وفصاله 30 شهرا حتى إذا بلغ أشده وبلغ 40 سنة قال رب أوزعني أن أشكر نعمتك التي أنعمت علي وعلى والدي وأن أعمل صالحا ترضاه وأصلح لي في ذريتي إني تبت إليك وإني من المسلمين.
We have enjoined man to be kind to his parents. His mother bears him in hardship and brings him forth with hardship, and his gestation and weaning take 30 months. When he comes of age and reaches 40 years, he says, My Lord, inspire me to give thanks for your blessing with my parents, and that I may do righteous deeds which may please you, and invest my offspring with righteousness. Indeed, I have turned to you in penitence, and I am one of the Muslims. If you remember, last Friday, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah, we said, the eternal bliss of paradise is a reward from the Almighty Creator for the true believers, for their firm faith and their righteous deeds. since sincere belief from the depth of the heart is not limited to mere verbal expression of faith, but is accompanied by virtuous deeds and practical steadfastness. We also said that a person who firmly believes in God and has trust in Him will not fear anyone or anything, in view of the fact that it is righteous belief that grants peace and tranquility to the soul, in contrast to the lack of inward calm and anxiety engulfing the disbelievers, even the rich ones. The ayah that we recited to you now points to the hardships of pregnancy, delivery, and suckling of infants by mothers, who enjoy a special privilege and therefore deserve kindness from children, since the loving Creator has embedded these traits in the innate nature of both children and parents, irrespective of the creed one follows. A person's life and felicity is based on kindness and compassion. And since parents are part of the very existence of children, God Almighty enjoins children to do good to their parents. In this vein, motherly love for her child is one of the wonders and secrets of creation. Since despite suffering many hardships during 9 months of pregnancy and the painful delivery that follows, her love for her child, even if the baby happens to be ugly or deformed, or grows into a troublesome person, her love for the child she had given birth to and suckled never turns into disgust. This process of childbearing and weaning lasts for 30 months, as pointed out by the ayah, which means mothers bear the burden of begetting and rearing the child, compared with fathers, whose hardships, of course, for the proper upbringing of children are of a different nature, such as providing provisions, housing, and education until the son or daughter grow into responsible adults. As the ayah specifies, regarding duty toward parents on the basis of the intellect that a person fully attains by the age of 40, when he or she has achieved the perfect state of physical and mental development, and perhaps has children themselves, to discern clearly whether to tread the path of felicity or go astray. At this age, a person has children of his or her own, but this doesn't mean neglecting the elderly parents on the pretext of caring for one's own children. Thus, a virtuous person regards duty towards parents, including love and affection for them, as acts of worship, and invokes God Almighty to help him to be more dutiful while seeking the welfare and guidance of his or her own offspring. From this ayah we'll learn that, number one, Islam lays emphasis on both parental love for the children and the duties of the children towards parents throughout their life, even if they have matured in age with families of their own. Number two, the reciprocal love of parents and children is part of innate human nature, which means lack of affection towards each other is not just a violation of one's own nature, but disobedience towards God. Number three, the mother enjoys a privileged position in a practicing Muslim family in view of the hardships she went through during pregnancy, childbirth, and suckling, all of which created in her a deep love for her children. And number four, the noble Quran commands us to seek God's blessings for the parents, as well as for one's own children, along with their proper upbringing, values which the secular culture of the West sorely lacks, resulting in the disintegration of families and upsurge of crimes and other social ills.